system stable. Stand by.
Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip to the stars.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. 10. Ground control 9, to Major Tom.
8, 7.
Ignition, and may God's love
lift
be
off
with you.
For centuries, humans have looked into the night sky in wonder, gazing at the stars and imagining worlds far away. Gazing at the clear night sky is escapism at its best, reconnecting us to the natural world while giving us a sense of cosmic scale. Astronomy reminds us that we are small creatures on a planet tucked into orbit around a yellow star in an outer arm of a huge galaxy. It can answer questions about why things are the way they are today and what we might see in the future. And anyone can participate. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shireen Seewert. Today, we delve into backyard astronomy, ways to explore the night sky easily at home without all that expensive equipment. Stargazers say that each time you step outside, you find something new, something amazing. And looking up at the stars can be a mindful meditation tool, a way to relieve stress and spark your creative mind. And there are few places more suited to nighttime sky viewing than North Central Wisconsin, away from big city lights that can dim your view. Today, we welcome two guests to explain what to look for in the sky this summer and what you need to know to get started. Joining us today is Chris Janssen, Planetarium Director at the Wausau School District. Chris, thank you so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Also joining us today is Aaron Steffen, Associate Professor of Astronomy at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. Aaron, welcome to Route 51.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners with questions for our guests can join the conversation by calling us at 800-780-9742 or email us at route51@wpr.org. Aaron, let's start with you. How did you first become interested in astronomy?
Well, astronomy is one of those subjects that I think grasps people's imaginations very quickly. It's kind of like talking with kids about dinosaurs. Everyone sort of has an interest in the night sky. But I really wanted to become an astronomer after watching Carl Sagan's Cosmos series, the original Cosmos series. His wonderful poetry about the undiscovered, you know, the shores of the cosmic ocean and going out and exploring space and the discussion of the planets and the stars and the immensity of it all really just captured my imagination.
About you? I mean, what's your story? Is this something that you've always found fascinating? When did you get started in astronomy, Chris?
Well, Cosmos definitely played a role. I mean, to just sit and watch that PBS show, that was groundbreaking stuff. I would have to say the first time was I was at a camp and there was a star guide. It was a park ranger. He took a few of us out after a campfire. And I remember just being out under the stars and having a guide for the first time talk about letting your eyes dark adapt. A truck drove by out in the distance and he's like, everyone close your eyes. You know, don't look at the truck is gone. You can open your eyes, everybody. And just this part of being a group of this connection point. So it was really that park ranger that took us out initially. And then of course, Cosmos and Star Trek and science fiction, you know, being part of this cosmic community. So exciting.
Absolutely. And tell us what you do for the Wausau School District. Explain your role there.
Yeah, my role is I'm the planetarium director. So we have a really nice planetarium, seats about 50 people inside Wausau West High School, and it has had an upgrade in the last 5 years. So we've been open to the public on Friday nights, not last year, but I hope to this fall. We'll go back to our regular Friday night shows. And so it's a nice opportunity for Friday family entertainment to come and see a show. We change the shows every couple months. Bring your questions. It's live. You know, we can answer questions and things. The best part of the show is the people who come with their questions and their kids. It's pretty cool.
I've been to one. They're very fun. They really are. I'd like to start with the basics. So, Aaron, explain, what is the study of astronomy, and tell us how it's different from astrology.
Astronomy is the study of the night sky and the objects in it. The idea of studying our sun, studying our moon, the planets, and the stars that we see, and the galaxies that we see. So really, astronomy is almost an all-encompassing science, studying from the very small particles of solar wind that are captured in Earth's magnetic field, all the way up to the universe as a whole. And it was the same as astrology about 400 years ago. The idea that the heavens could have some effect on us here on Earth was an interesting one, and also was shown to be true given the sun clearly has an influence on the surface of the Earth, right? The moon creates tides, so it clearly has an influence on the Earth. So it wasn't that much of a mental leap for people to believe that the sun, the moon, and the planets had an effect on their own personal lives. So that is where astrology comes from. And astronomy is the scientific branch that broke off from astrology, using scientific methods, studying our place in the universe and the properties of those objects around us.
So, Chris, what does astronomy teach us? Why is studying the stars and the planets important?
Well, I'm going to bounce right off of what, Aaron, you started. One of my absolute favorite scientists, people of the past, worthy of people's study, is Johannes Kepler, the first astronomer. Up until that point, there was this idea of you could will it, or you could call the magic unicorns to tell your future, or if the position of Mars is in a certain spot, it means we should go to war. And along comes Kepler, and he's empirical. He's paying attention to the data, and he profoundly does not want to believe in what the data is telling him. But the data is clear. And he struggles for most of his life, and he's put into exile for his religious beliefs. And he finally comes to the conclusion the data has to be correct. And so I think the thing that I learned about this astronomy versus astrology kind of turnover is this adherence to empiricism. The data does the talking. And it was kind of a, I know that the Renaissance had already happened for humanity, but Kepler for astronomy, and I think for science, was a huge part of that next step for us. Empiricism matters. Data matters. It does not believe, your beliefs does not affect the outcome.
When we look into the sky, stars and other objects, and they all kind of seem the same when you're looking with the naked eye. You see these twinkling things, and they look beautiful, but there's not much difference between them when you're just first looking at them. But scientists use the electromagnetic spectrum to help them study like black holes and neutron stars and galaxies. Aaron, can you briefly explain the electromagnetic spectrum and how that relates to what we see in the night sky?
Oh, certainly. The electromagnetic spectrum, think of it like a rainbow that you get out of a prism. We take light from a star, like our sun, and break it up into a spectrum or a range of colors. And what we found was, it's difficult to see from a small prism in your house, but with a scientific grade prism, you can see missing lines where colors are absent. And that allows us to see what materials, what atoms and molecules exist in our sun. In fact, of course, the element helium is named after Helios, god of the sun, was first discovered in the sun's spectrum before it was ever discovered on Earth. And once they realized this new element existed, they looked for it and found it on Earth. It's so chemically inert that they just really didn't have a good way of locating it. So we can use the spectrum, we can break up the light from a star and analyze it to get so much information. We can determine the star's surface temperature. We can determine the star's properties. We can determine what astronomers call metallicity, how many heavy elements exist in a star. And by heavy elements, astronomers use metallicity as any element heavier than helium. So how much oxygen, carbon, nitrogen, as well as iron, is present in a star. And not only with stars, spectra allow us to study the surfaces of planets, the atmospheres of extrasolar planets as they pass in front of their parent star, and the composition of giant clouds of gas and dust in our galaxy.
Okay, Milky Way is our home galaxy. Can you explain, Aaron, what's a galaxy exactly for people who might not quite understand what that is?
A galaxy, I often compare it to a city. If each house is a star, a galaxy is a city. And cities can be large and small, just like galaxies can be. So a galaxy is a collection of gas and dust and a bunch of stars that are gravitationally bound together. And galaxies, there are two major types of galaxies, elliptical galaxies, which kind of look like ovals, and our galaxy, a beautiful spiral galaxy. Our galaxy contains anywhere between 200 to 400 billion stars, some smaller than our sun, some much bigger. And our sun goes around our galaxy about every 220 million years. So the last time Earth was in this area of the galaxy, dinosaurs had just started walking on our planet. And these galaxies exist in the observable universe. There's upwards of 100 billion galaxies. The Milky Way exists in an area called the Local Group, where we have our galaxy, the Andromeda Galaxy, our nearest large neighbor, and a few dozen other very small galaxies all gravitationally bound together.
And you mentioned its shape. How do we know what shape the Milky Way is? I mean, how do we know?
The Milky Way can be seen at night from your backyard if you allow your eyes to adjust and you're not in the city. What the Milky Way gets its name from the idea that it looks like a sort of a thin cirrus haze overhead that completely wraps around the sky. It's like we're inside of a pancake, if you will, and that torus, that donut, goes around us from our perspective, from our point of view. All the stars that we see in the night sky are our local neighbors. The Milky Way is made up of the collected light of millions and millions of stars too faint to see individually. And then we also know that we are in a spiral galaxy, not because we can travel out of the galaxy and take a picture of it. It'd be awesome if we could, but that's just not possible.
Right? Yeah.
But looking at the other galaxies we have in the universe. And again, there are three major types. There's ellipticals, there's spirals, and then there are irregular galaxies, which are galaxies that are in the process of merging or have recently merged. So the universe is still active and dynamic even today. But looking at, again, the distribution of stars, the distribution of gas and dust, we can tell that we are in a spiral galaxy.
Chris, what are some of the ideal conditions for viewing the Milky Way? Is there a specific time we can see it? What's the best way to check that out?
Yeah, well, the biggest thing that really destroys the view of the Milky Way is light pollution. Because as Aaron mentioned, these are millions of stars, very, very distant. And we measure something called magnitude, a visual or apparent magnitude. And the human eye really is only capable of seeing maybe up to fifth magnitude. And the scale is inverted. I like to think about it, the Greeks liked races. So a first place finisher is brighter than a second place finisher, which is brighter than a third place finisher, and so on. And so the first magnitude stars are the brightest stars of the race. And the human eye can get down to about fifth. Well, most light pollution we have in the city blows away fifth or sixth or seventh or anything dimmer than that. And the Milky Way you're talking about is around that threshold, fifth, sixth magnitude, fourth magnitude, maybe some brighter areas. And so really the light pollution's the killer. You have to get away from city lights to see it. And then over the course of the evening, the beautiful thing is it's like a seatbelt all the way around you. And it's sometimes it's along the horizon. So you're like, well, you're outside, it's perfectly dark. Where's the Milky Way? Well, it's around the horizon, and you just have to wait a couple hours till that seatbelt, rises a little higher up in the sky.
Thank you. You're listening to Aaron Stephan and Chris Janssen, our guests today on Route 51, as we continue our discussion on backyard astronomy. What amazing things have you seen in the night sky? We'd love to hear from you, too. Join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can email us, too, at route51@wpr.org. I'm Shireen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shireen Seewert. Chris Janssen and Aaron Steffen are our guests today for an introduction to the cosmos and a guide to backyard astronomy, something anyone can do, and it doesn't cost a penny. What would you like to know about the night sky? Email us at route51@wpr.org or join us by phone. The number to call is 800-780-9742. In a moment, I want to talk about some tips for beginners and what to look for, but I want to touch on black holes, because I must admit that my only knowledge of black holes comes from like Star Trek. So, Aaron, what is a black hole? What do we know about them?
A black hole is an object that is so dense that the escape speed to get away from it exceeds the speed of light. So on Earth, for example, if you want to get away from Earth's gravity, we can do that, and we have. You just need to get on a rocket that accelerates you to about 11 kilometers per second, about 8-ish miles an hour, 8 miles a second to escape Earth's gravity. But if we were able to crush Earth down to about a little bit smaller than a centimeter or so, the escape speed from that object would exceed the speed of light. So what ends up happening is nothing can escape a black hole. Now, black holes, we believe, are the endpoint of massive stars, stars that are 25 times the mass of the sun or larger. When they explode in a supernova, the forces inside crush this object, the core, down into a black hole. So it's a stellar remnant. And we have observed these famously. I think Cygnus X-1 is a great example. It's a massive star orbiting rapidly around nothing. So we don't see black holes directly until about 2 years ago. We see their effects on their surroundings. Centers of galaxies have what we call supermassive black holes. These are black holes millions or billions of times more massive than our sun. And about 2 years ago, they was the first time astronomers were able to actually image the accretion disk around a supermassive black hole in the galaxy M87. Which was an incredibly difficult feat, but again, provides this wonderful supporting idea for this type of very strange object.
Interesting. And you said supernova. Can you tell people what a supernova is too?
A supernova is the death of a massive star. When it runs out of fuel in its core, it basically is like a house of cards, in that once it starts producing iron in its core, iron doesn't release energy when you fuse it together like lighter elements do. It takes energy. So you knock out the supporting structure of that star, the star collapses on itself rapidly, and that releases a shockwave and a huge amount of power. So to give you an example of how much, if the sun, the sun can't go supernova, it's too small. But if the sun went supernova, or I put the world's biggest nuclear bomb to your eyeball and detonated it, the sun being supernova 93 million miles away would still be millions of times brighter.
Okay.
So it's an incredibly powerful explosion.
Okay. Thank you for explaining that. It's just one of those phrases that we hear and maybe don't always understand. As we discussed, studying the night sky can really be done for free. Of course, you can buy some fancy equipment, but you can just do it by looking up at a cloudless night. But for those who want to go a step further, what equipment makes it easier? Are binoculars enough? Chris, what do you think?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that I'd like to get across to folks is I want to be an amateur astronomer. You don't need to even buy binoculars. The cool thing about astronomy is I like to call it the sliding budget of time and money. So let's say right now you've got a 10-year-old and you've only got 30 minutes before bed and you have no money. You can be an amateur astronomer. What's that astronomy is super powerful. Step out after dinner, watch the sunset or on a walk, and you look up in the sky and you just see, oh, hey, there's some bright things. I think they're planets. I don't know. What are those? And that you're an astronomer. You're outside, you're gazing, you see these objects, you could then just appreciate them. But as you say, Shireen, we're going to go one step farther. So what I would suggest for people who want to move that slider up the budget scale of time and money, they might next want to say, well, I'm going to invest an hour into some free apps. I would really suggest a smartphone app. There are some good ones out there, really good ones. There's so many. I don't want to even mention one to hazard to forget some, but you literally would whip your phone out of your pocket, hold it up to the sky, and it just tells you, oh, that's Saturn and Jupiter over there in the southeast. Cool. What's that bright red thing? You just whip the phone out, literally spin it around until, oh, that's Arcturus. And I think that if you have a loved one with you, your kids especially, they'll just look at you like you're some kind of wizard, right? How did you do that? But now, Dad, Mom, you know. And so a smartphone app for free or a couple of bucks would recommend as the first real start. You can also hook yourself up with International Space Station apps. My wife does not like that app because we'll be at the dinner table and all of a sudden it goes off. And so my daughter and I run outside to try to catch the space station over our house, you know, leave our dinner sit there cold. or the Northern Lights warning, you know, the 2 a.m, my phone's going off, Northern Lights, go outside, you know, but I'm willing to put that slider of time a little higher on the scale, I think, than some folks, sure. But beginners, definitely check out some smartphone apps. Binoculars would be the next step if you're really wanting to increase that light gathering power to see some darker objects.
And Aaron, let's ask you, I mean, what kinds of cool things can we see with binoculars? Can you see quite a bit? Do you need expensive ones?
Oh, no. If you can see the object with your naked eye, like, for example, you can see Jupiter, Saturn as a small point of light, is more than enough light coming in. So you can just use small binoculars you use for bird watching, maybe a 6 zoom or an 8 zoom. And with those, you can start to see the rings of Saturn. You can start to see Jupiter's 4 Galilean moons. The moons Galileo first discovered when he turned his first telescope to the night sky. One of those, Ganymede, is larger than the planet Mercury. Io is more volcanic than Earth. Europa has more liquid water on it than Earth does. Trapped beneath the ice. So these are astoundingly neat objects. And they change position from night to night. So you can go from one night, look at those objects. You might only see 3 moons because one of them is hiding behind Jupiter. Go out the next night and you can see all 4. And again, the smartphone app, if you hold up your smartphone there and zoom in, it will show you and name which planets are in, they form a little line around Jupiter. With binoculars, you can see with larger binoculars like 8x50s or 10x50s, you can start to see the core of the Andromeda Galaxy a little bit better in a dark location. You can see some just interesting stars, and the color of the star starts to appear. Our eyes are really interesting things. With faint light, like with stars, you only trigger basically the rods in your eye, which are black and white sensitive. Imagine going into your closet at night in the dark. You can't really see the colors of your clothes, but you can see your clothes are there. But when you start capturing more light, then the color becomes more apparent. And that's why these beautiful Hubble images are so colorful, right? And you might use your own small pair of binoculars and not quite see that color.
Great. What about when you're buying a telescope? If you want to go the route of buying a telescope and investing some, you know, some real money into this hobby, are there different kinds? What should you look for when buying a telescope? Aaron, do you have some thoughts?
This is actually interesting. I almost lost my interest in astronomy because my parents, trying to fuel my interest, bought me a very inexpensive telescope. And it was advertised as a very high power zoom. And of course, people think, well, the bigger the zoom, the better the telescope. It was terrible. By the time I finally got Jupiter in the eyepiece, but I would walk away, you know, to get my dad. By the time he came back, it was gone. So telescope purchasing, you don't want to get the biggest zoom. What telescopes are light buckets. They're trying to put a mirror or a lens of a certain size, bring that light down into your eye. My ideal type of telescope would be, and Chris could, I'm sure, has made these suggestions as well, an equatorial mount. The idea is that the telescope is on an axis pointing at the North Star and spins once a day, with maybe a little battery motor. And what that does is it counteracts Earth's spin, so it keeps objects in the field of view. They don't wander away. And those aren't too expensive for just a very basic equatorial mount. And if you want to get really fancy for a few $1,000s, you can get Celestron and has telescopes, for example, that you set it up, it knows where it is on the Earth with GPS, it knows what time of day it is, it slews to a star and says, hey, is this, you know, Arcturus? Yes. It slews to another star and says, is this Vega? Yes. And then you can just go anywhere you want to. Show me Jupiter, show me Mercury, show me whatever.
Great. Chris, what's a perfect night for stargazing? What makes the perfect time to go out and check out the stars?
Wow. Well, what is the perfect telescope? The one that's with you? What is the perfect night for stargazing? The one that you can go out and it's clear. So many nights you can't because you have to go to work. You know, there's other commitments. So the perfect night for stargazing is basically, I think, on the observer more than outside. Yes, there, you want to get away from light pollution, but definitely low humidity, if possible. Humidity can blur things, you know, take some color away. So you want low humidity. And I hate to say this, but cold nights have those low humidities. So Wisconsin, on a really cold night, you've got some really great viewing. Where the moon is not going to cause a problem. So we'll talk about in a meteor shower coming up, we don't have a full moon. So it's going to get rid of a light source in the sky. And then really, that's pretty much it. Low humidity, dark, no moon, away from city lights. And then I want to highlight too, it's important that your location site is really scoped out. There's been numerous times in my life where I have stumbled into some dangerous positions. This idea of, oh, it's a beautiful night. Get in the car, kids, let's go. And you just head out to the country and you say, this is a good spot to stop. And you hop out of the car and you realize there's poison ivy. You know, I just laid down in poison ivy. There's barbed wire. I stepped in, you know, rusty barbed wire. Cow manure here in Wisconsin is there. You're trespassing. There's other situations out in the national park where we were very close to a cliff and we didn't even realize it until the next morning. So safety, make sure that the location you're going to, you know where it is, you've been there during the day, you know there's no streetlights out that are going to surprise you, you have permission to be there, there's no, you know, dangerous things around you, there's no skunks or... So I guess if someone's going to go out, definitely make sure your area is safe.
So other than constellations and planets, what are some other cool objects you can see in the night sky, Aaron?
You can see, again, the Andromeda Galaxy is an interesting thing you can see. With, again, a pair of binoculars, on a very dark night, if you're away from light pollution and you look slightly off, don't look directly where the Andromeda Galaxy, but look sort of at the side with the side of your eye, which is more light sensitive, you can see the nucleus of the Andromeda Galaxy. Other interesting objects are more random. Comets, for example. Comets are beautiful objects when they come by, but we only know of a very few that have a regular period. Most famously, of course, Halley's Comet. But Hale-Bopp in 2002 was a gorgeous comet. And those occur, you know, every few years or so. We'll get maybe a small comet that you might be able to see with binoculars. But the really big, beautiful ones are rare. Northern Lights is a great example of something you can see at night, as Chris mentioned. But again, that's due to the space weather from the sun. Does the sun have a coronal mass ejection or a solar flare? And is Earth passing through that? And usually there's only about a 2 to 3 day window after the event occurs before we get notified that the Northern Lights might be visible here in Wisconsin. If you live in Alaska or, you know, Scandinavian countries, Northern Lights is a common occurrence. Here in central Wisconsin, we do get them, but not terribly often. So there's other interesting things. The moon, of course, is a fun thing to look at, especially if you look at the Terminator, that line between the light and the dark of the moon, you can actually see the relief of the mountains on the moon with a small pair of binoculars. So while if the moon's out and is ruining the rest of your night sky, the faint objects, you could use that opportunity to look at the moon itself. So a lot of neat, and of course the Milky Way. So there's a lot of neat things you can see. But for constellations, I just want to say one neat way to learn constellations is constellation hopping. Most people can identify the Big Dipper pretty easily, but then using a smartphone app, like Chris mentioned, you can then figure out how to get to Polaris and the Little Dipper, and then learn about the constellations around that area. And it's a wonderful way of learning the night sky. And of course, as the seasons change, the constellations in our southern sky change as well, right? Orion the Hunter is a winter constellation, for example, which is a beautiful, bright Taurus, the Bull, and so on. So those are really neat constellations that we can learn with those smartphone apps or just a guidebook.
Chris?
Aaron, I want to jump off of what you mentioned before about start with Big Dipper. Those are circumpolar constellations. They're out year-round, and we like to call those the Fab Five. So when you go outside and somebody's like, well, I don't know, what's that? What's Orion? You know, Scorpius. Start with Big Dipper, always first. Jump to North Star, Little Dipper. Keep going to Cepheus, Cassiopeia, find Draco. The Fabulous Five are out all year round. And so if you know those Fabulous Five constellations in the north, you're going to be another wizard. Every time you go outside, you're going to be able to find something if you know those Fab Five.
Why is it that some constellations we only see during the summer and others during the winter? What's the story there, Chris?
Well, it has to do with your position on the Earth as well. Let's see, without getting visual, I have to talk this through. Imagine you're on a merry-go-round. And there's not many around in playgrounds anymore, but depending on how your head is positioned. So let's say you're laying back on a merry-go-round, which I don't recommend. You're going to see the oak tree above you, but you're not going to be able to see, you know, the school building as you spin. So if you change your position of your head, you might be able to say, oh, I can't see the oak tree above my head anymore, but I can see the school doors swing by every once in a while. That's about what's happening here. We're up in the northern hemisphere, so we're able to see these stuff above our heads all the time. And the stuff down in the south, the seasonal constellations, they're like down lower from our viewpoint.
Before we take a break, I wanted to just ask you briefly about moons, moon viewing. Aaron, you were talking a little bit about moons. There's always a lot of hoopla about super moons. So what are super moons and what are blue moons? What are those?
A super moon is the name given to a moon that is near what we call perigee. So the moon's orbit is not perfectly circular. Sometimes the moon's a little bit closer to the Earth, sometimes it's a little bit further away. And when you have a full moon near perigee, where the moon is closest to the Earth, the moon's about 10% or so bigger in the sky, it's a bit brighter. And that's what we call a supermoon. And then each moon over the season usually is associated with a name. Like a harvest moon, most people have probably heard of, seed moon, beaver moon, yule moon, wolf moon. And a blue moon, there are two definitions. The old definition was it's the third full moon in any season with four. So think of the season starting from spring, from March 21st or so to June 21st. Normally you'd have three full moons in there. But if four squeezes in, the third full moon would be called a blue moon. And this happens every 2 to 3 years. So once in a blue moon meant once every 2 to 3 years. Because of, I think it was at Sky and Telescope magazine, printed an incorrect article, blue moons are now often considered the second full moon in a month. So there's kind of two definitions, the original astronomy definition and this newer definition. So a blue moon is if you have a month with two full moons, the second full moon is often called a blue moon.
So they don't look different, do they?
Not at all, no.
Okay. What about the supermoon? Does the supermoon look different? Is it,
it
really
would look
larger?
Brighter. Yeah, it is bright. It is slightly larger. It is slightly brighter, but it would be hard. The way humans see light logarithmically, it's difficult to compare things if we don't have them right in front of us. So unless you had two full moons, one normal, one super, it'd be a little tough to see, which one is the super moon. But it does make a very bright moon, but you don't want to observe the moon when it's full. It's kind of boring. You want to observe it when it's a crescent or when it's gibbous, mostly full. And look at that terminator, and that's where you can see the cool relief from the mountains.
So you can see more detail when it's not full.
Yeah, that's, the light isn't shining directly down on the mountains. You get shadows from the mountains if it's not full.
And Chris, what is the best time to see the moon? Is there a specific time of night, or really does it change or depend on the season?
Well, the moon changes every day. Moves about 5 degrees. If you hold your fist up to the sky, about 5 degrees. So sometimes you might see a moon in the morning, 6 a.m. And then other times you might see the moon in the middle of the day. So over the course of the 28-day moon cycle, you're going to have, it won't be out at night. It might be out in the morning. So there's really not a time I can give you. Always go out at, you know, 5 p.m. to see the moon. It changes every day of its cycle.
You're listening to Chris Janssen and Aaron Steffen, our guests today on Route 51, as we take a tour of the night sky in north central Wisconsin. When we return, we'll talk about some specific astronomical events to watch for this summer. What would you like to know? You can ask questions by calling 800-780-9742 or email us at route51@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seewert. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. Aaron Steffen and Chris Janssen are guests today for a discussion on backyard astronomy with tips on how to make the most of the summer night sky. We'd love to hear from you, too. Email us at route51@wpr.org or join us by phone by calling 800-780-9742. In just a moment, I'm going to ask you about some of the upcoming phenomena, like the meteor shower that we're expecting. But we do have a caller. Kel is on the phone. Kel is from Sugar Camp and has a question for you. Welcome to Route 51, Kel.
Thank you for taking my call. I have two questions. The first one is, when can we start to actually identify Orion? When does it start showing up that we can actually see part of it? What month or time of month? And the second question is, has anybody step forward to help that fellow who built that wonderful planetarium, I think in north central Wisconsin? He was getting older and he couldn't keep it up. And I thought that was a monumental achievement for somebody to build a planetarium. And I was hoping that it would be preserved. So those are my two questions.
Thank you, Kel. Chris, what do you think about Orion? Can you answer that? When will that be visible?
Yeah, there's really two phases to that question. For those who really want to get up early, you can see it. I'm just checking. Aaron, I think, what is it like? We could almost see it starting now if you wanted to get up at like 4 a.m. before sunrise.
I think so, yes.
So in the evening sky, you have to wait till like December, January. So there's the stargazers who are the pre-dawn stargazers. That is not me. And then there's the folks who are the evening stargazers. So Orion, get up early. You can check it out. But you'll have to wait till December-ish to see, November, December-ish before you'll see Orion up nice and high in the sky.
And are either one of you familiar with the planetarium she is talking about? It's near Rhinelander, if I'm not mistaken. And it was in operation for some years. Had either of you been there? Or
I believe it was Kovac Planetarium.
Yes.
And I have been there. It's a very fascinating planetarium, painted on the inside with glow-in-the-dark stars by hand. Really a neat engineering marvel in north central Wisconsin. I do not know if it is still in operation if it's still taking. I believe they have a website you can go to, but I haven't been there in a few years.
Yeah, there was a book called The Man Who Painted the Stars, which is where Frank talks about his dad, Frank Kovac. I think he started a Kickstarter campaign to try to raise some money to add to the engineering of this wood structure that is, you know, quite frankly, how does it even be, you know, there with its immense weight? I don't think the Kickstarter was successful, though, so I believe it is still closed to the public, but it is not like scrubbed. It's still there. It's just not open to the public right now, I don't think.
Okay.
Especially not this last year.
Right. I had heard some rumblings that they may be reopening at least on a partial schedule. So we'll have to keep an eye on that. It'll be interesting for sure. One of the big attractions in the sky this summer is meteor showers. The Perseid will peak next week, I believe, between August 11th and 13th. But first of all, can you tell me the difference between a meteor, a meteoroid, and a meteorite? They all sound like the same thing. I'm sure they're not. So, Chris, what's the difference?
It's the same thing, Shireen. Students struggle with this one all the time. Like, it's a rock. A rock in space is an asteroid. A rock that's burning in the atmosphere is a meteor, and the same rock that hits the ground and you can buy for thousands of dollars per ounce or per pound is a meteorite. So it just depends on where that rock is located.
Okay. All right. Now I know. So,
yes.
So the Perseid meteor shower, when is it going to be the best time to watch that? And what should we be looking for, Aaron?
The Perseid meteor shower, since it won't have near a full moon, it should be relatively dark sky. And what you want to do is just find a place that has good viewing around you, so you don't have a lot of tall trees. And sit back, if you have a zero gravity chair, bring that, lay back or lay it back on the ground, look up. And during this time, you can see meteors at any time of the year. It's when space debris, rocks, or satellite pieces that we've had up there for a while come tumbling back down to Earth. But the meteor showers are areas where Earth passes through a dense grouping of debris left behind by typically a comet. So you're more likely to get meteors, a higher rate of meteors during that time. And by higher rate, maybe one a minute or so. Some can be, history has shown there's been meteor showers that have been spectacular in the past, and others that, aren't quite as neat. I think people have a misconception with meteor showers. I know I did when I was little. I expected it to look like rain coming down from the sky. And that's not what you see. But you do see these streaks. And then every once in a while, you can get a bolide, which is basically a meteor that comes in a little bit lower in the atmosphere, a little bit closer to you. And you see it as a streak of green or red light before it, blows up or slows down because of Earth's atmosphere.
Sure, Chris?
Some people really wonder why we only have about 10 or 12 meteor showers per year. And as Aaron mentioned, they're from this debris of this comet. And the best analogy I've ever used was imagine comets, they leave a lot of debris behind. Imagine a garbage truck, a really poorly designed garbage truck comes through your neighborhood once a week and leaves a debris field behind, wrappers and garbage and things. And it's not by your house, but when you have to drive to work, you drive through the debris field to get to your destination. So comets leave a debris field, and then you drive with the Earth drives through that debris field once a year, and that's when we get that that increased chance of meteors. And it's really exciting. I have an 11-year-old, and for the last 5 years or so, we just go outside and we only carve out 1 hour. That's all my wife will allow me to, from midnight to one that late. 1 hour, we just go outside and we just keep count. And it's so neat because you're just laying there. It's usually a nice night, put a little bug spray on or something. And you'll just, you get these excited moments. And after, 10 minutes, we'll teach a little bit. I'll teach some math. Like, okay, that's six we saw in 10 minutes. So how much is that per hour? So you do a little mental math. Last year during the Perseids, we counted about 12 here in the city. That this is not a dark sky condition. So 12 per hour, it's about one every 5 minutes. That's pretty cool, actually, to go outside and see, a shooting star, as they call it, every 5 minutes. This Perseid meteor shower for next week is supposed to get it to about 50 under ideal conditions. So even people who are like on the outskirts of town, you might easily see a 25, 30 per hour. And we're talking about every 3 or 4 minutes a meteor.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, pretty spectacular, assuming there's no clouds. Next week is super exciting. No full moon. Everyone get outside next week.
So what are some of the other celestial events that are happening this summer that we should be watching for? I know Jupiter will be at opposition in August as well, and there is a blue moon in August too. Aaron, what are you looking forward to?
I think seeing Jupiter and Saturn in the night sky in the evening, and then watching how they move apart from one another, because we're all the planets are race cars on a racetrack racing around the sun, Mercury being the fastest on the inner track. And as you go further out, they get slower. So Jupiter being brighter than Saturn, also closer to the sun, it moves faster against the background of stars. So you can see Jupiter and Saturn moving with respect to one another from night to night, slowly. But also then looking at the moons of Jupiter and seeing how they change from night to night. And looking at, again, the neat part about the fall coming up is it gets darker earlier. So it's easier to go out and look at the night sky and not have to stay up until, 11 p.m., 12 p.m. And it's also fun if you get out right after sunset or right before sunrise, look for satellites. Satellites are also visible, not just the International Space Station or Starlink, but just satellites that have been up there for a while. You can see them slowly move against the background of stars, but usually only around sunrise and sunset.
I want to shift to what's going on in the world of astronomy today. And as astronomers, you probably get asked a lot about Elon Musk and SpaceX and the push to get to Mars. What do you think about these recent developments in space exploration? Chris, what are your thoughts?
Well, this started a number of years ago when they outsourced, I think there was three competing companies for the next space shuttle or reusable device. It's nice to see ingenuity being utilized. I like to see humans get out to Mars. I mean, who doesn't want to see humans on Mars? It's exciting. The Starlink satellites, I'm a little bit bittersweet on, because I know they have a reentry plan, but we have a problem with space junk around our planet, and it's really starting to affect research-grade astronomy. We've got the Hubble's above this are at the same level as this stuff or slightly above, but ground-based telescopes, you spend a couple hours looking at a particular star field or at least 30 minutes or so, and you're investing a lot of money in this research, and then have a Starlink satellite zip across the field, and it's ruined. So I'm a bittersweet a little bit. I wish we would do a better job of being responsible with our space junk up there. There still no is international law about a reentry system. We can just launch something up there and there's no way to bring it down, nor do we have to have a way to bring it down.
We've got about 1 minute until we have to wrap up. And I just, one final question. For me, it's impossible to look at the stars and planets without wondering if there's life on other planets and other galaxies. Aaron, what do you think? Is there life out there?
I think there is. I don't think it's visited us at all. But given the immense number of planets just in our galaxy, 200 to 400 billion stars, each star having likely several, half a dozen to a dozen planets, you're talking potentially trillions of planets in our own, just our galaxy alone. So the likelihood of life is elsewhere, I think, is strong. But at the same time, there are some barriers to get to the point where we are, where we're an intelligent, communicative civilization. Like if humans didn't exist, there'd be life on this planet, but no one would know.
That's all we have time for today on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. I'd like to thank our guests once again, Wausau School District Planetarium Director Chris Janssen and UW Stevens Point Associate Professor Aaron Steffen. Our producer is Joy Ratch-Kramer. Our executive producer today is Rick Ryer. Rick is also our on-air producer today. Special music from David Bowie. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at WPR.org/Route 51. Next week, we'll take a look at the history and appeal of Wisconsin's supper clubs. And in 2 weeks, we welcome local bluegrass artists for a lively music and festival preview. Until then, we're heading out of town.